Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. I'm Josh Beiser, and we got a great podcast for you tonight. My guest is the CEO of Beta Dwarf. Please welcome to the cast, Stefan Groening.
Thank you very much.
Stefan, it's a pleasure to have you on tonight.
Cool, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So, to get things rolling, for people who may not know about who you are or Beta Dwarf, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your studio?
Yeah, I could. So let me start with myself. I just turned 30, which was kind of a challenge, yeah. But I've been involved in Beta Dwarf for 5 years actually now. I just had my 5-year anniversary thing on LinkedIn where people say, wow, nice and so on. Before that, I had started two other companies. I have always wanted to be in game development and probably also have a game company. So I kind of laid the way to get there, and I did that very, I don't know, dedicated or, yeah. So I found this entrepreneurial book that told me that I should start and fail two companies, and the third one would then be the success. And that's sort of also what came true. So my first company was actually a web cocktail bar that delivered cocktails like pizzas, and it went horribly wrong, but I learned a lot from it. And then I started a web bureau, and finally I started Beta Dwarf with my partner Kenneth. We did that during our studies in Copenhagen. So right after our bachelor, after I met Kenneth, actually when I first met Kenneth at our studies, I thought I would never have had anything to do with that guy because he was like super annoying and always really loud. And I remember at one time I actually asked my group to leave that group room because it was very annoying to be in the same room as him because he was extremely loud. And a year after, so we ended up being in a group together, and I realized he was a really, really good programmer. And he taught me a lot, and we actually got, we figured out we had very common interests. And then we started making games and so on. And when we were done with the bachelor, we realized that the game we had done at that point was pretty awesome. And so did our fellow students think. So they became fond of the idea of doing something more serious. And I started to fletch out the idea of Forced, which was our first game. And originally it was actually an endless runner for Facebook. It makes no sense at all, given the context of how it actually, ended up being. but at that point, we kind of like in the, is it called Fight Club, the movie? Yeah, I think so. So we took it extremely serious. Kenneth and I founded the company, and then we were student teachers. So we had the what can you call it? The advantage of knowing who the bright people in all the different classes were. So we kind of invited those with small secret stickers, telling them to, if you're interested in making games and you're serious about it and so on, then please show up at this date in this room and so on. And then this funny little night, we had managed to gather seven other people than us, six guys and a girl. And they were pretty interested in what we had to do. And I planned a 2 hours talk about the game and how our company were going to be started if they were in. And after that, they basically all said that they were in. And so we founded it and started out the day after. But we had no money at all. So it was also a little embarrassing that that we asked the other guys to pay for their company t-shirts and so on. And looking back on that, I would probably have regretted that and paid it myself. But that was how it went. We started out and we spent a ton of time on making the game and so on. And after 6 months or so, where we just crunched doing during school basically, we started to sleep at the campus a lot. And when we reached the summer vacation, we sort of realized that the next 2 months there will be absolutely no people at the school, so we might as well like move some furniture in there, get some couches, get some mattresses and some fridges and so on, and have a better place. So we found like one of the coolest classrooms, and then we decorated and made it our home for the next 2 months, and it was a really, really awesome summer vacation. We had like these, I don't know, 28,000 square meters for ourselves. And the university was quite isolated, so it was in the middle of nowhere. And people, yeah, for that reason, never came to the university during summers. Only some weird old lecturers and so on. Mm-hmm. And then the magic thing happened after those 2 months, because we thought we would definitely be thrown out, because of course somebody would use this this classroom for teaching or something like that. But nobody actually came, and we realized that that none of the three different campuses who were rented classrooms at the campus actually decided to rent this classroom. So it was like not in use for the next half. Yeah, for the next semester or something, which we realized a week after or something that the school started. So that's where it popped for us, and we got the idea of actually moving into the classroom. And so most of us actually abandoned our apartments and saved the rent instead. And then we started living in this classroom. We divided it with the room dividers, these like movable small walls that you could set up, and then we had a little sleeping area, and then a work area. And that's how it went on for the next 7 months. And after that, that was in January or something, three years ago, I guess. One morning, some teacher came by, and obviously we hadn't been granted the permission to be there. And then she just opened the door, and we had got really bad habits because we've lived there without never being visited and so on. So we were probably sitting in our underwear or something, brushing our teeth while making the game in the morning, and this teacher just looked upon us and basically just left without saying a word. And I don't know, half an hour later or something, she brought some more administrative personnel, and we were kicked out, I would say. And we were asked to leave all basically they hadn't seen all the madrasas and so on at that point, so they were pretty angry about the idea that we've been sleeping there more than nine people for half a year because of the practicalities of danger for fire and so on. You were not allowed to sleep there. So I guess he yelled a bit at the janitor. But luckily we had applied for some government funds, or like a Danish Film Institute fund that had some small amounts of money that you could apply for if you were doing some artistic stuff. And we managed to be the first student who got that. And that allowed us to... Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Sorry, it was just my computer went to sleep. Yeah, then we spent all that money. No, basically, we just like said, okay, shit, this is hugely devastating to our project. What should we do? And the school actually tried to solve it a little for us. They said that they could get us another room because they admittedly thought that what we have done was pretty cool as well. Or at least half of the school thought, and the other half thought we should be thrown away or something. And then I remember the day, they walked over to another room, and then they showed us the room that we could get. And then I said, well, it can probably fit five persons or something, and we are 12 at this point. And then they said, yeah, but can't you just work in shifts? and that kind of was the comment that led us to the idea that we definitely had to find some other place to be. And so we basically Googled the cheapest place to live in Denmark, and there was like three different spots, and we took the one that was closest to us. So it was like 1-2 hours in a train or something. And so we packed everything up and moved into the house together, all of us. And then we lived there for a year, which was really, really isolated. We were in, even more in the middle of nowhere than the university. And then the whole day was, because we didn't really have any money out there, everything was spent on making the game and just buying food and so on. So, but it was still like a dream. Now we had our own place, and we need not to be scared about cleaning personnel or something waking us up in the middle of the night, or stealing the way we cooked food at the university was going in routines. We kind of knew, almost like in a prison or something, how the teachers were cooking their food or when they were going and what their schedules were. So we knew exactly when to wash our dishes in the dishwasher and when to use the cooking services and so on. Mm-hmm. And now we were totally free in our hut. Yeah. But now we had to make all these crazy rules for how, I mean, we had to make rules for not to eat, what's it called, pre-made pizzas, because there was so much garbage involved in that. And we were in a normal family house in the middle of a family place. And those houses and the garbage rules there and so on were fitted to small families and not 16 people eating thousands of pizzas these days. So the first week we managed to overfill the garbage wagons by four times as much or something. We got complaints by the neighbors about rats, and we quickly had to find solutions for that. It was overly complex of in relation to what you would have imagined doing such a simple thing as just moving together there. But apparently there was not standard, and we had to find really special garbage collectors to come and fix that and so on. It was extremely expensive. But nevertheless, it was still super awesome to be there. We had our garden and we grilled and we made the game. And we spent a year out there, and then we started to have wasted all our money. And I think that's how it goes with a lot of developers that start out. That for instance, we started, we thought it would take half a year to make Forest, and it ended up taking almost 3 years. Mm-hmm. But during that whole process, we always thought that it would only take half a year to finish. Mm-hmm. And that's the crazy mentality that I guess you're bound to fail at. So that when we spent all the money there, our next attempt was to go to Kickstarter. And we did that. And it was also a really, really emotional roller coaster, because the first few days was really, really good. We got 25% or something of what we needed in 3 days or something. And we thought, okay, this is no problem. But then it took a few days, and then we were totally stagnated and we got no more backers and so on. And it just felt so wrong to walk around and beg your Facebook friends to share that and all that stuff. But that's basically what we had to do. But at the end of the day, it was more like a viral thing that saved the Kickstarter. 7 days or something before it was going dead. We have these tough rules where if you don't get your amount, then it's too bad. And I guess you guys know all about that. Mm-hmm. So we did kind of a viral attempt every night at 8 o'clock or something. We had the deal that we had to find a viral attempt and throw it out. And we did that for like 10 days in a row or something, until something really awesome happened. I mean, we tried a 24-hour live streaming for the whole period. So basically backers could just tune in and see what kind of zoo animals were making the game that they were begging. And we thought that could be cool and so on, but it never really took off. It was really cozy, and we got a lot of super fans, so to say, that we enjoyed having during the road a lot. But other than that, and the most really successful attempt we did was this picture that told the story of us in a really simplistic way. And I think the cool thing about a picture is that you don't really need to be you don't need to have a cool accent, or you don't need to be a Tim Schafer or something on camera, because pictures you're just professional, because and that really, really worked well for us. But the funny thing about that is that it was such a coincidence that I just wanted to share it on Facebook with some friends, and I thought that would be like with some luck it would be a little interesting. But the peculiar thing was that I needed to put it on a server to easily share it, and then I just thought Imgur, that's what you do on Imgur. But I didn't know that there was like this Reddit thing or front page on Imgur or something where it could get popular. I had no clue about that. So when I was uploading the picture and it said, could it be submitted to gallery? It was more like, yeah, why not? And I had no clue what it was. Then I went to bed, and 6 hours later or something, my phone vibrator went crazy on the room. We were like, everybody was sleeping at the top floor and a few guys in the cellar, but at the top floor we were like 7 guys or something sleeping in 3 different rooms without doors. Mm-hmm. So people of course got annoyed with my phone vibrating on the wooden floor that was really loud, and normally I don't really get mails at night and so on, but here it sounded like it was ringing, and that was because we suddenly got like, 20 mails or something per minute, and that was because of how the picture had went viral, and everybody was starting to bag it. And within a few hours, we had collected, I don't know, 20,000 bucks or something. Mm-hmm. And we were home. It was a home run. And then, of course, everybody was happy. And the Kickstarter ended successfully. And then that was one thing that definitely went well. But then you also have to grow with that and realize that, again, even though it was like $60,000 or something like that, it was still not a lot of money. But it definitely got us to Copenhagen and away from Karlslunde, which the city was named. And that was really good because our brains were totally isolated of living there together and never seeing friends or family or whatever. And we really had to get out of there and also meet other developers and get some sparring going and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved to Copenhagen after that. And what happened then? Yeah, we got just the cheapest place as the house we lived in, but it was like half as big. So we got a little more cramped, but also a few guys decided to get their own apartments. So at this point, I think we were only four or five living there. And then we spent half a year until we, again, funny enough, half a year, but then, yeah, we ran out of money again. And at this point we had, the way our company was structured was that we just, basically was totally voluntarily. I mean, everybody could be with us or not. If they were good, then we would, at small evaluation time stamps, basically give them some percentages of the revenue that we would get for a year after release. So basically, if you were super nice, you would get a small percentage of revenue for a year after Force would be released on, for instance, Steam. And the point in that was that the goal of this whole adventure was to establish a company where we could actually make games like we basically do now. And totally independent. So the philosophy was that if we totally divided all the percentage among everybody, then there would actually be no money to run the company afterwards. And so all the developers who joined us, basically, yeah, we made a big deal out of saying that they should definitely not join us for the money, but for the dream of the future and to hone their skills doing it. But it's still cool that so many people actually believed in that and to the greater, that was also good because it ended up being good, but it's still cool that you meet some crazy guy in a university and you trust him with several years of your time, based on that. And when we released Forced, we had, I think 29 people had been involved in making it. So that's a ton of people who really believed in the project. At no point were we more than 19 concurrent developers, but during the 2.5 years, 30 developers, almost 30 developers held out making it. So that's crazy. After half a year after we moved to Copenhagen, we again ran out of money, and the whole point of what I was telling was that nobody had gotten any payment from us.
Mm-hmm.
And this, and at that point, we were so sick and tired of asking people to give it half an extra half year and so on. And we decided to take a huge bank loan to actually pay people normal salaries. Well, not normal, but almost normal. At least so they could live and have no problems paying their rent and so on.
Hmm.
And so we applied for a bank loan. And I think it was $200,000. And that gave us, with normal salaries, around 3 months of work. That was really scary because we had never kept the deadline and everything always was estimated to take 6 months and it never did. But now we only have 3 months and we really, really had to finish it. And the most scary thing was at this point, we had been on green light for a year. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with the green light process?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, and we'd always been like ranked 50 or something, and we would always be, we would never climb the ladder. We would always be steady on 50, and we could do nothing to do it. And the scary thing about that was, of course, that if we wanted to get our investment back from the bank, we could not see that happening if we didn't release on Steam. So we went all the way we could for that. We found, instead of going for Greenlight, we realized that there was an Intel Level Up award that would actually give you access to Steam. And so we focused on making the coolest demo we could, and we submitted it to the Intel Level Up with the goal of winning our access to Steam. And it was actually a good idea because that's what we succeeded in, and it gave us access.
Mm-hmm.
And so we released. That's around 1.5 years ago now. And I guess, or I'm not, I don't guess, I know exactly why that went really well. That was again because of a picture. We knew that our marketing angle was the story that I've basically just told, but it's way better on pictures. and we made an even better picture. And I'm pretty sure last time I checked that it's become the second most seen picture on Imgur ever. Which is a little funny accomplishment in itself, because there's quite a lot of pictures being shared there.
Mm-hmm.
We released that 10 minutes after we released our game on Steam, and that went totally viral, both on Imgur and Reddit and everything. And I think it allowed us to, we went to top two best sellers on Steam and were selling better than the new Batman, who also came out the same day, and so on. So that was totally crazy and very unexpected from Steam, mm-hmm. also, which I can relate to why they would think that. But that was extremely nice, and so we just kept to it and tried to. I think maybe I should give you a breather for also being allowed to make the questions. Because I can keep rambling.
Yeah, definitely a fascinating story, Stefan. And it's really interesting, as we've spoken to a lot of developers over the last few months who've had, very unique paths going from, starting a studio to founding their game. When we spoke to the developer behind Robot Loves Kitty, she talked about how for the first 2 years they basically had to live in a treehouse to support
themselves. Yeah, I talked to her as well. That's such an awesome story. Yeah.
And it's really crazy about how, varied it is to become a game developer these days. Now, I mean, listening to your story, listening to their story, one of the challenges, I think, for a lot of enthusiasts or students listening to these casts is really trying to get a proper path to being a game developer, because really there isn't a path, straight set of guidelines to go from, student to making your own games.
There is not, no. But I do think it's hugely dependent on the scene in your country or where you are. And when we got out of our education, the scene in Denmark was not really developed, and it was there was only like one AAA studio called IO Interactive. They made Hitman and so on. You're probably familiar with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the only like big place. Then there was a lot of smaller companies. For instance, Playdead, who made Limbo,
mm-hmm.
and Press Play. But other than that, I think there was like 400 or 500 people involved in the industry in Denmark. So there really was no other option than doing our own company.
Yeah. And that's definitely around here. I'm on the east coast of U.S., New Jersey, and there really aren't a lot of major studios, at least within my general area. So it really comes down to either, A, you're going to have to relocate to where a studio is, or B, you're going to have to basically, put your foot down and make one of your own.
That's true, yeah. And then you just have to find the right path.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, moving on to talking a little bit more about Force itself. Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago that the original concept was Force was going to be an endless runner on Facebook. And what we got was something pretty much entirely different.
Yeah.
During development of Force, how did that transition happen from going from runner to this, co-op, hack and slash, almost puzzle hybrid type game?
Yeah, that's a good question. I keep asking myself, but I think it's because, like almost all game projects, I guess, evolve over time. There was there was a super clear idea, and we had a large design document detailing what we were to implement and so on. But as we sort of made the mechanics, we figured out other ways to utilize them, and suddenly we wanted to make it less of a runner, but more like an RPG co-op focused thing. And I think the co-op focus came from some side studies that we had during the education, where we spent a lot of energy on figuring out what makes a good co-op game. And we delved a lot into the idea of shared resources, mm-hmm. and that shared resources made people communicate. And then we, from all the fruits that we got from that study, we thought, hey, why not utilize the knowledge we've gained from this and focus on co-op instead? And then we sort of did that. And we experimented with all the kinds of different shared resources you could get, for instance, shared health, shared mana, and all these things. And at the end of the day, we figured out that what you had to share, it would definitely be most effective if it was something really visual and visual. Mm-hmm. And that became the orb from the game, which for people who doesn't know Faust, you could call it a reversed football. So instead of kicking it, you call it, but it's still like a shared thing that you maneuver on the battlefield or in a football match. So yeah, I think, but it took it probably took 8 months or something before we really, really settled on the concept. Yeah.
Okay.
But right, just to not to talk about it totally, but for instance, right now with Force 2, it's kind of the same thing. We're not totally sure of where we're going, but we have a pretty good idea. And it wouldn't surprise me if it's totally different when we release it.
Okay. And we'll talk a little bit more about Force 2 probably later on in the cast. Now, with Force, as you said, that you guys were, you said, like 7-8 months into development when you started to make that transition from runner to this more co-op-based game. Now, one of the challenges that we've seen when talking to developers is knowing when to either, you know, defend or stick with an idea, or knowing when it's time to cut your losses and do something else. As you guys were developing Force, what was like sort of the decision to make this dramatic shift in terms of game design?
I think it was actually, it's really, really funky that one could think like that, but it was an extremely ambitious project, and we mm-hmm. thought we would kind of conquer Facebook with it, because Facebook didn't have 3D games, we thought, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have like the coolest thing. Unfortunately, our graphics at that point really, really sucked, and it looks a lot nothing like what it does in Force now. But then we thought, why not kind of finance the extremely big project by releasing part of the game as a more isolated adventure on Steam first?
Mm-hmm.
We had no idea how hard it was to get on Steam at that point. So it was like, yeah. But it was really naive to think that we could do that. And we also suffered from that by spending like 2 years to get on Steam. Now mm-hmm. it's obviously a little easier, but yeah, still. That was the shift. So we wanted to make it more of an, instead of an open-ended, you know, open runners are like, you can play them forever, like a hobby or something like that. Never really end. But so we decided to make a game that was scoped in a way that was less stressful, because we could see it into it. It had a start and an end. And yeah, we could relate to that.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about how Force started in terms of getting onto Facebook and trying to be a big game there, that was one of the things that we started to hear a little bit about 2 years ago, with developers trying to make that push towards Facebook, trying to compete with, you know, the social games on there, Farmville, Candy Crush, etc. And it seems like, at least for like the last few months, that sort of idea has kind of died, that the trying to compete with these smaller, you know, casual games with more complicated stuff just doesn't work anymore. Would you say that's sort of been the case, you know, from your own studies and your own research onto the Facebook platform?
I would probably agree, yes. The only time we've considered Facebook was in the start. We would never go back to it now, I think, unless it changes so much. But our whole team is totally like into hardcore 3D graphics and requires 7 GPUs and a huge computer to run.
Mm-hmm.
And we probably couldn't make something cool on an iPhone nowadays.
Yeah. Man, I'm glad you brought up the iPhone and mobile development, Stefan, because this is another issue that we've been hearing from a lot of developers, something that we've been seeing with just the catalog of games, that seems like it's becoming also very hard to really make a name for yourself on the mobile market. And a lot of people who moved from, you know, free-to-play or AAA to mobile are now making the move away from mobile to either a AA studio or to indie development. And it does seem like the mobile market may be heading towards some kind of crash or some kind of restructuring in terms of sustaining itself.
Yeah, I think the whole industry is totally filled with developers, and I think it's a problem that's both hitting, yeah, basically every corner of the market.
Yeah.
Because Steam is also getting flooded, just not as quickly. It's so easy to make a game startup nowadays, and I think that's why we see so many games. And it's super hard to be known or anything like that. The only good news is that there's also a lot of new gamers, and Steam is getting super big, so it can feed a lot of people, and so does the other platforms. So many people are getting consoles and so on. And for instance, now it seems like we also have a slight chance to get into the Chinese market, because some new consoles opening up there who have a lot of money and can pay up front for porting and so on. So there's tons of opportunities, but it's so hard to navigate.
Yeah. And with Steam itself, or especially with any development on the computer, one thing that it seems to be happening, at least from my viewpoint, is that the market seems to be bottoming out, in the sense that you can't really release, you know, like a bargain, you know, basement type game anymore, you know, something that you put together in, you know, a month or 2 months and then try to get $10-$15 out of it anymore. It seems like today the indie market has really been forced to step up its game and try to, you know, compete with each other with very unique projects.
And that's definitely true. I mean, there's so much entertainment to choose from and so little time to spend. And I think it's been really explicit. I don't know if you've seen what's going around on the social channels with this little app or plugin that can check how many time or hours it takes to complete your Steam library. Have you seen that?
I saw it, and I'm too afraid to put my information in there.
Yeah, but I think that sort of it totally states the problem, that there's so much education or entertainment to choose from that people only have time for the best.
Yeah, and the best these days is becoming a lot harder to pick out, because, again, we've got so many indie developers that, while they're not really stepping on each other's toes in terms of, you know, similar products, there's just only so much money to go around that you can't really spend, you know, $20 every week on a brand new game. You know, very few people have that income coming in.
Yeah, that's true. And then again, there's things like Hearthstone or something that I've spent way too many those on.
Yeah, the free-to-play market has really become its own beast as well. You have Hearthstone, there's, of course, League of Legends, Dota 2, and these are games that they've practically have sustained and grown themselves even without having that barrier of entry with the cost.
Yeah, and it's definitely also been something we've thought about, but it also, then again, it requires you to pay for a server structure, and it's not really an indie-friendly thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it is really interesting if you want to do a community-based game where other players provide value to other players by simply being available to play with, that then the free-to-play approach is very interesting.
Yeah. Now, going back to Force, I have a few gameplay-related questions for you, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the structure of Beta Dwarf. One part of Force I found interesting was the puzzle design. As you mentioned a few minutes ago with the orb and how you relate it to football with having to pass it back and forth to each other, part of the challenges of the puzzles of the game is that cooperation, that you have to get the orb to certain positions or you have to maneuver it around obstacles. What was the general philosophy or design that you guys came up with for creating the puzzles and the gameplay surrounding that orb?
The general philosophy was that we wanted to make the game demand that you communicate it. So that's also the point of the orb, that you sort of have to ask your partner to call it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just kick it to him. And in that way, you when people play, or even strangers at conferences and so on, they usually sit and talk a lot when they play the game, and that was one of our design goals. So a lot of the puzzles and the combat is very much oriented about communication.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of playing the game, when I was playing with friends, I was only able to get one friend, so we were playing with two people. Does the game change dramatically when you have three or four people in a game at a time?
It was definitely one of the things we spent a ton of time on. We sort of manually tweaked every single level to fit the amount of players that were in it. So since it was a puzzle game, we also had to sort of tweak some of the puzzles to fit the amount of players. And it was definitely something that took a long time. It's not 100% purely super well done, but I would say it's 80 or 90% there. The only thing that was and still I can't figure out. Maybe if we did something similar to this game format, I think we might have considered not including single player. Single player is mainly there to, because there's so many people who wanted it, and we did the best to make something that was fun, but definitely Forced is supposed to be enjoyed by friends.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up single player stuff, because that was going to be one of my complaints with the game that I was going to ask you about, because that was the first thing that I tried, because obviously I saw a single player on the thing, I thought, okay, I could play that first. And looking at the game through single player versus multiplayer, it really is a completely different beast. The game really lends itself more to multiplayer. It's not really developed for just having one guy on the field, whether it's because of how the puzzles are shaped or the fact that you're so easily swarmed by enemies that you really need to have two or three other bodies on the field to, you know, to run interference for you.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely completable in single player, but it's extremely punishing. But one of our design goals with the game was also to make it like kind of a Demon Souls difficulty, that it would be extremely punishing. And one of the reasons for that was also that we believed, also based on our studies and philosophy and so on, that you would be more okay with failing based on a hardcore difficulty curve if you were playing with friends rather than if you were playing alone. Mm-hmm. Because you would develop more of that team spirit where your partner would say, okay, we got it this time and so on. And but that's sort of not really there in single player.
Yeah, and again, as you were saying, that as you were trying the game out and showing to people who are playing multiplayer, it really is a lot of fun when you have four guys, you know, trying to get the orb around and just the general chaoticness of multiplayer. And it's a lot different when you fail in multiplayer than you do in single player, because when you have, you know, the chaoticness of multiplayer, you can sort of be more relaxed than if it's single player and you die and there's nothing else you could have done to really circumvent that.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people comparing it with raiding in World of Warcraft, and that was also kind of what we aimed a little at, that you would see this challenge that would take you between 2 and 4 minutes or something, and you had to figure out how to most efficiently overcome it as a team.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to do in single player.
Now, another part of Force I want to talk about quickly is the progression model in terms of unlocking new abilities for your character. Because unlike a traditional like ARPG or game really with just any kind of RPG progression, instead of getting experience or leveling up, the progression is tied to completing the challenges of the game. And for those of you listening who haven't played the game, every arena in Force has 3 challenges to basically get crystals or progression from. You get a crystal for beating the level, you get one for completing an optional side objective, and then you get a crystal for beating the part-time on that level. And then as you get more crystals, this will unlock new skills and passive abilities for the 4 weapons or classes you can choose from. Now, for you, Stefan, how did you guys come up with that progression model for the game?
It was based on the idea that we wanted no grinding at all in the game. We wanted a game where if I told you that I completed it, then if you played the game, you would have an idea of what that meant. And you couldn't say, yeah, okay, that's because you grinded for 6 hours and then everything would be easy. So we only wanted to reward players when they had actually completed something. And in that way, we could sort of keep the challenge curve, but it also diverted the game totally away from casual games. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a hardcore experience where you definitely have to earn your achievements. And I'm not sure how, at the end of the day, how smart that direction was, but at least it did fit a lot of hardcore players. I mean, we ended up having quite a lot of, for instance, famous League of Legends players streaming it because it was like it was totally their ball game. They liked the action and that it was super challenging. And that was also our aim. But it probably has frightened away some of the more casual audience. Mm-hmm. Again, the idea of the skill system, sorry for the diversion, was that you also had, whenever you failed, we wanted to give you a possibility to tackle the challenge in a different way. And that is why we wanted no permanent skill choices, so you could easily try out a new strategy for your venture.
And it's funny how you just said that the game now has that hardcore following, because again, as we were talking about earlier, that this originally started out to be a very casual runner-like experience, and now we got this hardcore, you know, cooperative game, raids, almost a Demon's Souls-type difficulty system.
I think that this very much because when we started out, we thought we wouldn't have really a lot of time to make the game, and our ambitions just grew, and it became more of a team game instead of, I mean, a game that we made as a team rather than me just having the vision alone. So in that way it was evolved over a long time.
Now I guess one last general question about Force then, and that is about the boss battles in the game. Each of the bosses also had a very different design mentality compared to other games or other cooperative games. How did you guys come up with the boss designs for Force?
They took a lot of time to figure out. We basically for it was a demand for all of the challenges or all of the arenas in the game to utilize the orb mechanic in some way, and especially the bosses had to take the orb into account. For instance, the first boss, the only way that you can get him away if he has sort of grabbed you is to call the orb, and you have to do it before he kills you. And simultaneously, the orb in that arena is also the only one that can activate the shrines that push all the enemies away. So you have to constantly sort of maneuver it in the right pattern there. And I think that's also one of the things I'm really happy about in Force, because it's not just about dealing enough damage in a short amount of time. There's always some clever maneuvering involved in most of the challenges, and especially in those boss fights. But the boss fights are also, I would say, for instance, the last boss is like insanely hard. And it's also funny when sometimes when we are told we have a bug or something in the fourth boss or something like that, then we try to go in and play him, and it always takes a lot of time to reach the area because it's so hard even for us.
All right. Yeah, definitely interesting discussion we've had about Force so far, and it's fascinating as we've talked over the last almost 50 minutes so far on this cast. It's basically the origin of this game, going from this very casual affair to turning into a very hardcore, very cooperative-focused title. So let's move on and talk a little bit more about Beardwarf, and then we will return to Force 2 briefly. Now, as we were talking about before the cast, Beardwarf, in terms of a studio managing it, is a lot different compared to other traditional indie or AA or AAA studios. So, Stefan, could you talk a little bit more about what makes Beardwarf so different in terms of running it as a studio?
Yeah, so our focus after we sort of got success was to obviously form it into something more serious than just a startup and make a system that would be encouraging for many years to come. And so we very much designed our company approach as a team. And it's been focused on not really having a hierarchy and focused on being basically a toolbox of knowledge that that all the different actors in the company can pluck from. So everybody can sort of propose an idea and be part of that and so on. And the key is then that when you work in the company, your responsibility is simply to focus on what brings the most value while you have the most fun of doing it. So there's no real roles, only externally, and everybody can, for instance, if somebody just wanted to go down and buy a new computer, they can do that. It's more like a technocracy rather than a democracy. So if you're in doubt of anything, you should just ask a peer. If that person also agrees, and you both feel it's a good idea, then you can do it. That's also, you would spend a lot of the company's money on stuff in that way. So everybody basically has access to a credit card, and there's nobody telling you no. So there's a huge responsibility on everybody's shoulders, but thereby also lots of momentum and freedom. And so everybody sort of gets the same pay. And then every month or every second month, we evaluate each other. And then we divide bonuses based on those evaluations, meaning that everybody in the company basically have 10 bosses, which is their colleagues, and then they get scores from them. And those scores are their extra revenue. And so every quarter of a year, we divide the amount of income we have that extends the money we paid to run the company.
Okay. Now, at this point in time, how many employees does Beta Dwarf have?
12.
Okay. Now, as you were saying, in terms of having this flat structure for management and running things, for enthusiasts or students listening to the podcast right now, you probably heard something familiar to that from Valve Software, who also runs a very flat management style. Now, Stefan, did you guys sort of take inspiration from Valve when setting up your company's hierarchy?
We definitely did. The only thing we sort of had to figure out ourselves was how we did the shared revenue and things like that. We took huge inspiration in the hierarchy approach and evaluating each other and so on. And Valve was also so kind as to spend several hours sitting down with us and talking about how we could approach this and so on. So that's been very helpful.
Cool. Now, in terms of setting up this flat management structure, for people listening to this, and even for my own curiosity, were there any, like, I guess, major cons to this style that you guys had to work around with? Or has it all been, you know, very beneficial to you and your company?
I would say it has been extremely beneficial, yes. It's been, I mean, whenever we've had an argument, it's been pretty easy to get onwards by simply considering what would be the alternative. And the alternative would most often be some kind of a normal structure where, let's say we had an argument about something and we didn't know how to decide. Well, then in a normal structure, there would be some kind of responsible department lead or something who would take that call. And everybody sort of doesn't really find that a cool way and would rather think that the best argument should be the way to go. And I think it's extremely rare that we have anything that we're stuck in. I think we're really, really, really good to just follow the best argument. And I think that has definitely worked way better than I would have expected when we implemented this system.
Okay.
And people take so much more responsibility, even in the smallest of things, because now lame things as electricity is something that's suddenly relevant to everybody, because if we find a way to do that more efficiently, then it's good for everybody. So yesterday, I remember our art director said, wow, we have three fridges running, but one of them is almost empty. Let's unplug it and find another solution and so on. And that was one of the boring things that I would probably have done if I had to micromanage and I was the only one interested in cutting those small costs and so on. So I think we are much more of a team now where everybody has some spare energy to consider these small things that can be optimized.
Yep. And that's very interesting. You said that, Stefan, about how the team comes together as a whole, as opposed to, you know, being these separate departments, you know, separate groups within the same company. And that's something that we've sort of seen happen with a lot of indie startups or a lot of indie developers who take that step into formally becoming a studio, that, you know, when you only have 5 people or 12 people in Beta Dwarf's case, you really do need to be that collective whole. You can't have one person have to take care of everything, because you're just not that, your company needs to be, you know, cohesive in that front.
Yeah, precisely, yeah. Another thing that sort of happens is that once you don't really have a hierarchy, you don't really have anyone to point fingers at. And that's also some of the things that Valve stressed also in their way of doing their games in the Cabal structure, where there's no like single vision holder that you can sort of put all the blame on if things go wrong. So you have to take much more responsibility. And I think the games you make and everything becomes more solid based on that.
Yep, definitely. Now, I guess one last question that I have regarding the flat hierarchy structure for you is, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, you said that after Force came out and you started to, you know, look at Beta Dwarf and create Forman more as a company, did you guys have the idea to do a normal hierarchy structure for it? Or did the idea to do flat sort of come, you know, immediately as you started that foundation?
It came pretty immediately, I would say. The people who brought me into the industry and told me a little about it, and the idols that I had, for instance, Valve and so on, they were the ones that inspired this philosophy. And they all sort of said the key to making games is to make them as a team rather than being a tyrant and trying to force your ideas through. And that's, I think, has been key to the overall process. And why not also make the company like that? And then we had like this big banner bearer, and one of the most successful companies showing you how to do it, which was Valve. But
yeah,
end of the day, you think that it's easy to just do, and they have this manual that almost detailed describes how to do it. But when you start implementing it, you figure out that there's so many tiny details that you have no clue how Valve does. You have to figure out your own way to do it.
Yep, and definitely a good point there in terms of getting your studio up, because every studio really is different. You have different people, different opinions and mindsets that you have to deal with. And it's interesting how you guys were able to sit down with Valve like that and sort of get not exactly a complete guide, but the general blueprint to how they manage and run the company.
Yeah, that was really cool and probably a little unexpected, but... Yeah, but we visited them and we've done that a few times, and some of the times they had time to do some sparring. I guess it's also interesting for them that it's inspiring other companies. I guess former or older companies are more in the traditional format, and you could also say that if there's a few founders who've invested a lot or whatever, then they might not want to share it as much and so on. And it is a big deal to almost give all of the revenue away, but it's I think what also comes to mind is some CEOs and so on saying that you really break your company if you one day show up in a Ferrari and the other people doesn't have that. So if you have to show up in a Ferrari, you have to do it as a team.
Definitely. Okay. I think with that, are there any other parts of this flat hierarchy that you want to bring up, Stefan, or have we touched on all the big topics?
Pretty much. I think there's many more of us doing this. I know there are some Dutch guys who are also inspired by this philosophy, and we're sparring a little with them. So my point there would just be that if there's somebody out there doing the same, I would be happy to spar with them and figure out if we can learn them something or we can learn something from them.
Okay. I actually just thought of one last quick question regarding this, and then we'll move on. For any enthusiasts or students listening to this cast and listening to you talk about having this flat hierarchy structure for Beta Dwarf, are there any like common missteps or mistakes that either happen to Beta Dwarf or you talk to Valve with, or something that if someone's listening to this cast that they should try to avoid if they're going to set up the structure for their company or their startup?
I would say that as a general philosophy, it's very good to get teammates evaluating your process. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that when I invented this system, or detailed it, I didn't invent it because Valve did, but when I did it or formalized it for our company, I constantly went in and asked people in the team whether or not they thought this was a good idea, like this specific side rule. And I think the system was way better formulated based on that. There were so many small things that I didn't notice that I could then make better and so on. I guess that's simple user feedback, but it's just really important to utilize that. And then also be really careful about what you promise with, for instance, ref shares and so on, because if you promise a certain percentage, you can never go lower than that again. But at least it's really, really hard. So be sure to figure that out, and also don't be greedy. So make something, yeah, just listen to the team or basically become the team. For instance, I'm also being evaluated like others and so on. So, yeah, the more the team feeling, the better.
Interesting, yeah. And I'm sure we could probably have even more discussions on this, but I know we're probably going to be running out of time soon. But yeah, I would definitely love to talk more about this with you, Stefan, because it's always interesting to talk about I guess, the general running of indie studios. Because, again, for people listening to this cast who are on the enthusiasts or just play video games in general, they may not know the, you know, the inner workings of what goes into making these games.
True, yeah. And it's probably very different from company to company.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I think with that, let's move on to our final topic, and we'll talk briefly about Force 2. Now, looking at what you guys have put up on Steam, Force 2 looks to be a very different game compared to the first one. So, could you talk to us just like a little bit about what's going to entail in the sequel?
Yes, there are sort of two, or basically three cornerstones that has been our design pillars for Force 2. One is that we want to blend action games and card games. So we wanted to, whenever you have, I don't know, 5 minutes of action gameplay, we wanted to offer the player an interesting choice of playing a randomly drawn card. Mm-hmm. And involve deck building. And we haven't really seen deck building in action games before, or at least we really tried to find examples of it. And some of our players already call it like Diablo mixed with Hearthstone. And that's one of the things that we try to do. The other thing we try to do is to do a competitive roguelike. So the roguelike genre has definitely enjoyed a good comeback in the last couple of years. And we sort of, that's really a genre we enjoy. And we wanted to see if we could elaborate on that. And that was to make it competitive and basically make it PvP. So we have a really funky twist on that. And the last thing was to make it extremely stream friendly. So we're trying to basically allow the player to, if they overlook the game, to understand everything that's happening all the time. For instance, not that at all that as a Dota is a brilliant game, but it's super hardcore to understand. Mm. And it's really non-stream friendly because you can't even overwatch everything at the same time. Whereas, for instance, football is much easier to understand because you can see the whole field at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's been our third design goal.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to what you just said in terms of combining this action game with the deck building of a CCG, in terms of the general gameplay, are there going to be classes in Force 2, or is it just more about whatever cards or whatever your deck is that you're bringing into each one of the levels or matches?
Just to make it really easy, it's very Hearthstone inspired. Hearthstone, we checked out a lot of different CCGs. We're also very much Magic players, but we wanted like something that could be easily understood. And I guess Hearthstone is the most casual approach to that. And it also simplifies deck building a little because you choose your character and then you have limited cards to put into your deck. So it's kind of an easy way into CCGs. Mm-hmm. And it also fitted our game very much because in our game we not just have a little like 2D picture of our characters, we have a fully fledged 3D character running around throwing magic missiles. So so that also fitted our game a little better. So basically, yeah, you have your characters and then you modify their skills randomly over time based on the cards that you pick.
Okay. Now, in terms of like deck building or taking these cards into the matches, how many cards, I guess, are you really using or matching in a single level or a single match?
A match typically takes between 8 and 16 minutes, I would say. You probably play a card every minute, I would say, on an average. Mm-hmm. You have when basically the game is about going into an arena and it's extremely random generated, so it's really hard to predict what you're against, and then you just utilize the tools that you have to best accomplish that. And if you accomplish it, you get a set amount of mana that you can spend on surviving more than your opponent.
Okay, now we mentioned that it is a roguelike. If you die in the game, like, what's the penalty for death? Like, what's going to give it the roguelike feel?
That you simply die and you've lost and there's nothing good in that. And you have to start all over. That is most apparent in the sort of single-player introduction. Force is more, way more single-player oriented. There's actually no co-op in it. Instead, there is PvP. Mm-hmm. But the big part of the start is you on a journey alone where you sort of learn the kind of the system of the game and tackled with a lot of interesting challenges. You could almost call it Binding of Isaac or something in the start, but with the cards. But after some hours, there's a little bit of lore that sort of builds up and says that you're fighting to sort of get access to the real arenas and so on, where you face real opponents. And in there, you basically have matchmaking. And the goal there is then that you find these other players, and then we randomly generate a set of really nasty arenas, and your job is simply to survive longer than your opponent. And the interesting thing is right now that while you play, your opponent becomes kind of a summoner that can actually attack you, but you cannot attack him. Mm-hmm. So if you survive, the roles switch, and then you continue on until one of you die. And that becomes a really different kind of PvP, even though there's direct interaction.
Yeah, it definitely sounds a lot interesting. Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago that part of the inspiration for Force 2 is Hearthstone. Now, as we said with the collectible card or deck building aspect of the game, that you're building this deck, are there any like monetization plans you guys have for, you know, like buying new cards or boosters or stuff like that? Or is it just handled entirely with in-game currency?
We are pretty sure that you will be able to buy booster packs. Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of the Hearthstone model, but we are not 100% sure. We might also do it expansion pack based.
Okay.
But yeah, one of the biggest aims is that we know that it will have a premium cost to start with. There's tons of reasons for that. And based on that, for instance, imagine I cannot reveal whatever the price will be for the game, but let's say it's something like the Forced 1 price tag, then we would make sure that the sort of value that you get from that would be for free in the game when you have it to start with. So compare that with Hearthstone. You have the Naxxramas campaign that would, for instance, come for free then.
Okay.
So there would be tons of cards, legendaries and so on, that you would have when you're done playing the introduction and the campaign.
All right. Now, I do want to just clarify one thing. As we said that the cards or your deck will define your strategies during the match, when you're playing the game, do you have like a basic attack or basic set of skills that you can use as opposed to the cards, or do the cards practically define any and all possible strategies during a match?
That's a very nice question. Basically, we wanted to make it a bit mobile like there. So when you play, some character, you have to relate on what his skills do and what the buttons are mapped to and so on. And so that because it's still a really skill focused game, so you need to rely on that. So our philosophy there is that our cards cards simply manipulate those skills into something slightly different and can be utilized in different ways. So maybe you have an AoE explosion that is turned out to something slightly different based on the cards you play, and then the more hardcore players can really, really change those skills once they manage to play it. When they have played it a lot more. Okay. So one of the goals were also to, since you're playing it a lot, we wanted to make your input to the game or your actions varied from match to match. So you wouldn't have the exact same, for instance, if you play Dota and you play the same hero a lot, you end up having slightly the same build all the time or based on the strategy or whatever. It's not varying extremely much unless you're a super pro player and knows exactly how to counter and so on. And we wanted to offer a little more variance there. And it probably also becomes slightly more casual in that context.
Okay.
So you can probably catch me on going in a totally other direction now, because Force 1 had no RNG at all. And now Force 2 has lots of RNG with tons of randomness. And it's really funny to also experiment with that.
Okay.
But it's a more casual game than Force 1, but with tons of depth.
Definitely sounds interesting. Now, in terms of like the skill progression, as we mentioned with Force 1, you had it locked to completing the challenges and the trials. With Force 2, are you going the same route, or will there be a different progression system?
That is different. That is more like, again, Hearthstone, where you get the better you play, the more cards you are awarded with, and the more varied your playstyle can be, and you can sort of figure out the best combination. But there will actually be a meta in this game because you're facing real opponents, so you have to sort of face them off, and we would keep it balanced. And that's also what I really like about cards, because they can be rewarded to you, and you can get access to totally new ways to play your hero or your character. But they will never kill the balance by boosting you permanently with 10 strength or something like that, which mm-hmm. it's hugely complicated to work with in PvP, such as Diablo and so on, that's not even out yet.
Yeah. And again, this sounds very fascinating. I mean, you're pretty much hitting two of my favorite genres, with deck building and roguelike design together. So I'm definitely interested in looking at this. Do you have like any release dates in mind, or are you going to release, you know, an alpha or beta build or something like that?
So basically the game is very tight right now, but we want to add some extra features and we want to make it as perfect as possible. We are almost premiering it at PAX Prime in Boston at March. And we are aiming at doing an early access release on Steam this year.
Okay.
But we do not know the date yet.
Cool. Okay. Is there any other topics regarding Force 2 that I haven't brought up, or anything you would like to mention about it?
It's sort of a fault to say no to that, I guess. But what would be very important there? I guess people have to get used to the thought of playing less with your friends and more against them. But to compensate for that, we are really focused on doing a lot of like a player story focused game where lots of really funky stuff can happen. And one of the things that we utilize to that do that is, for instance, that a lot of enemies in the game will have much more friendly fire, mm-hmm. meaning that the scenery in the game can be much more chaotic, especially when you go to the more lunatic levels where there's small rocket firing rats and so on, that when you come into these arenas, they are almost alive and will fight each other instead. So you have to sort of figure out your own chaotic path in there. And I think that brings a lot of humor to the game that wasn't there before.
Cool. All right. I think with that said, we can probably start wrap things up. I would definitely love to talk to you more about Force 2. It sounds very interesting in terms of its design and its appeal.
Thank you very much, and I would love to talk to you about it.
Yep, and hopefully we can have you back on, hopefully within like the next few months or when it's closer to like an alpha or beta release.
Yeah, that would fit perfectly.
Awesome. So I think with that, my last question then for you, Stefan, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to the fans listening to the cast?
It's just been extremely joyful to be part of it, and I didn't even figure out that we'd spend so much time together already, so it was definitely joyful to be part of, and I would look forward to be part of it again.
Awesome. And yeah, like as I said at the beginning, Force was definitely an interesting game. I really wasn't expecting to find that depth there in terms of the co-op, but then once I got a few friends on, the game definitely took off. And as we've just said with Force 2, you guys are going in a different direction that also sounds really interesting. And I can't wait to check it out.
I'm glad you think that way.
All right. So for those of you listening, we're going to wrap up the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. First, if you would like to be either a guest on a future podcast or write a guest piece for the site, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted. And that also includes any developers listening who would like to be future panelists for our roundtable discussions. I'm always on the lookout for new guests there. And if you'd like to be put onto our applicant list, just shoot me an email. And lastly, if you'd like to contribute to our Patreon campaign to help get monthly funding for Game Wisdom, you can find all the information for that on our front page as well. With that said, thank you for listening to the Percepta Podcast this week. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.